Let me just start by saying how delighted I am to be here and to express my thanks for the kind invitation from Flaminia, Alexander, and Lucian. And it's great to be back at Perimeter, if only virtually. The main purpose of the talk is to throw a modicum of doubt over the standard connection in the literature between conservation of energy and the homogeneity of time. But before I get to Noether's theorem, which establishes supposedly that connection, I just wanted to make some very generic remarks about the nature of time, partly in response to issues that have come up in previous talks. And no doubt, in this way, I'll be exposing some of my own prejudices. So, Abhi Ashtekar on Tuesday started his talk by referring to the multifaceted nature of time. And yesterday, Renato Renner also referred to time as an overarching concept. And I feel this can't be overstated. So there's the, Abhi Ashtekar raised the issue of the hour of time and this completely separate issue of the time reversal invariance or otherwise of the non-gravitational interactions. And then there's the possibility that time is in some sense emergent. One of the topics that hasn't come up so much in this meeting, but which has given rise to an enormous amount of discussion amongst philosophers in particular, is the question of the nature of distance simultaneity. Yesterday, Renato Renner was talking about two ideal clocks side by side that tick in synchrony with each other. But then the question is, how do we spread time through space when we have distant clocks, and how do we understand that their phases are in sync? Now, Flaminia mentioned on Monday the difficulty of organizing a conference on a planet that has different time zones. And the fact that we have different time zones, of course we understand why we have them, but it's also clear that different time zones introduce an element of arbitrariness in defining those time zones. And in a way, it's the same in physics. We choose coordinate systems, and therefore we choose temporal coordinates in such a way as to simplify the fundamental laws of physics. And this is essentially what's going on by the adoption of the so-called Einstein-Poincaré synchrony convention for clocks. But really, ultimately, it's not so much a question of clocks, it's a question of the choice of coordinate systems. And the fact that the choice of a convenient coordinate system is to some extent conventional is precisely the insight that Einstein got from Poincaré in relation to a single coordinate system. That's to say, what he realized was that the synchrony convention for establishing the same times in different places has an element of conventionality. Without that understanding of the conventionality of distance simultaneity, Einstein could not understand the nature of the relativity of simultaneity in his relativity theory. This was the final insight that Einstein had. The conventionality of distance simultaneity was the final insight that Einstein had in developing his 1905 paper, Special Relativity and the Meaning of the Lorentz Transformations. Now, another aspect of time is that it seems to come with the notion of duration or a metric. And of course, that raises the question of how we understand the connection between time and clocks. But if we think of a thermodynamic type world, in thermodynamics, there are no clocks because there are no fundamental equations that have time derivatives. In what sense, therefore, do we talk about time in thermodynamics? Well, of course, there's change. Things change over time in thermodynamics. For isolated systems, the entropy increases over time. And so we are sort of drawn back to some of the slogans you sometimes come across about time. This is one that I've seen attributed both to Wheeler and something like it to Einstein. Time is what stops everything happening at once. Another way of putting this is that time is nature's way of getting around the law of non-contradiction. My hand is down, my hand is up. These are two contradicting propositions. It's time that gives us a way of understanding how we can get around the law of non-contradiction. So really this has to do with the fact that nature presents us with a multiplicity of instants. It's this notion of multiplicity in the world. Now, another slogan, of course, is time is money. And I've seen this attributed to Benjamin Franklin. Now, for some strange reason, this slogan never seems to come into physics textbooks. So I think I'm going to avoid it today. Well, the question, if we think, for example, of a thermodynamic type world where we could in principle have a multiplicity of instants but no duration. Of course, thermodynamics is not a fundamental theory. And it occurred to me during the course of this meeting that perhaps one of the lessons of the Page Wooder's entanglement model in quantum cosmology is that not only is it necessary in quantum cosmology for there to exist a multiplicity of instants, but also a metric. And this because of the way in which from a time-independent equation, a time-dependent equation emerges for the so-called system. Now, coming back to the issue of what time is more generally, Klaus Kiefer in his talk referred to an argument by Einstein defending general relativity by way of its application of the action-reaction principle. Einstein was saying the metric field acts on matter, matter acts on the metric field. This is an example of the action-reaction principle. And Einstein's point was that the validity of the principle in general relativity is not the case. And that's to say, the principle is not valid in special relativity, where the Minkowski metric is not acted upon by any of the goings-on in spacetime. And this raises an interesting question. Even Newton, with his absolute space and time, did not believe that they acted on anything. And the question is, if time is supposed to act, and therefore violate, in Minkowski spacetime, therefore violate the action-reaction principle, the thing that it surely acts on is clocks. And I would like just to question this in the following sense. Think, for example, of the distinction between, let's say, two measuring devices, standard measuring devices. Think of the thermometer. A thermometer works, you know, it determines the temperature of your body because there's an exchange of heat between the two systems. Similarly, the famous Stern-Gerlach experiment, the final spatial position of the silver atom is correlated, and therefore, in a sense, measures the spin of the relevant electron by way of mediation through the inhomogeneous magnetic field. Now, the notion of measurement in these two cases is subtly different because, of course, in generally speaking, in quantum mechanics, a measurement doesn't expose a pre-existing value of some quantity. But nonetheless, what's common in these two cases is that the object being measured is interacting with the measuring device. There's an interaction Hamiltonian involved. Now compare that to the case of a clock. So I've drawn down here basically a stopwatch, but this could stand in for a clock working on classical principles or a clock working on quantum mechanical principles. And the question is, what is it measuring? In the sense that, is there an interaction Hamiltonian between the degrees of freedom of the clock and, well, what? There isn't. The clock's action, it depends entirely on the dynamics of its own internal degrees of freedom. It is not reacting to something. Time is not acting on the clock. What is the clock doing? The clock is much to the extent that it's an ideal clock. And of course, as Newton realized, there are no such things in the universe, strictly speaking. The clock has been designed to march in step with the time in our fundamental equations in physics. So in other words, the slogan here would be, time is not defined by clocks. Clocks are defined by time. And that's how we construct them. We use our best theories of the workings of the clocks to ensure that they march in step with our fundamental equations. So in this sense, I would say time is weakly measured. It's not measured in the same sense that we talk about measurement processes in quantum mechanics, for example. And I think one has to bear in mind the absence of an action principle based on, regarding time, when one comes to think of the homogeneity of time, which I'll go into now. When it comes to Noether's theorems, I think we have to introduce an important distinction between two kinds of symmetry principles. Noether's theorem has to do with physics that has a Lagrangian or a variational formulation. So one starts with an action, an integral of a Lagrangian functional. Noether herself was interested in Lagrangian densities, which are functionals of independent and dependent variables, which are field, the dependent variables are field variables. And of course, applying Hamilton's principle, which is a completely distinct variational principle from Noether's, one ends up in which the field equations emerge. That's to say, the Euler-Lagrange expressions given here in this form, related to this form of the Lagrangian, these Euler-Lagrange equations vanish. Now, there is a notion of a dynamical symmetry, which is perhaps the most fundamental notion of symmetry in physics, which has to do with the introduction of changes of variables. It could be independent and or the dependent variables, which preserve the form of the equations of motion. So I'm going to call that a dynamical symmetry. That must be distinguished from a variational symmetry, which is a change of variables, the dependent and or independent variables, which in some sense preserve the action. Noether herself introduced the symmetry by way of claiming that when one has infinitesimal symmetries, infinitesimal transformations, to first order in the relevant parameters, the action is invariant under those transformations. That's what we might call a strict variational principle. But Noether herself was aware that the Lagrangians themselves have a kind of a gauge symmetry. You can always add to a Lagrangian a total derivative, given Hamilton's principle, doesn't affect the Euler-Lagrange equations. In other words, the dynamics is insensitive to this gauge freedom in the action and in the Lagrangian in this sense. So in 1921, at Noether's suggestion, Bessel Hagen generalized the notion of symmetry to one in which the variations in the variables lead not to a strict invariance of the action, but an invariance of the action up to a surface term, which is the same as saying invariance of the Lagrangian up to a total divergence. That's because of Gauss's theorem. So from now on, we're going to consider quasi-symmetries generally. And strict symmetries are just a special case of quasi-symmetries. Now, it's important to note here that a dynamical symmetry is not necessarily a variational symmetry. And I'll give an example of this later. There are straightforward examples of dynamical symmetries that are not variational symmetries. Now, it's widely regarded that if you have a variational symmetry, it's also a dynamical symmetry, but that's not necessarily true either. This will only hold, there's a theorem to the effect that a variational symmetry is a dynamical symmetry, only if all of the dependent variables, the fields in this case and the derivatives, the fields themselves are subject to Hamilton's principle, which in principle may not be the case, although generally speaking it is. Now, I prepared some slides going through the machinery of Noether's theorem, but for the sake of time, I'm going to run through these slides and get to some simple examples, which I think will bring out some of the subtleties of Noether's first theorem. And these examples are not sort of mainstream. These are examples that don't normally appear in the sort of textbook cases. So let's take, for our first case, the Fourier heat equation with constant diffusion coefficient D. So here's the equation. U is a scalar field, and in standard applications of the equation, U will be a temperature field when you're looking at heat diffusing in a solid. Now, why choose this equation. Well, one of the reasons we'll see in a moment, this is the real valued version, analog, of the Schrodinger equation, the time-dependent Schrodinger equation for a free particle. Now consider rescaling, let's call it the temperature field, the scalar field. So we just multiply the scalar field by a constant real number. This is clearly a symmetry of the heat equation. Now, is there an associated inertia charge? Is there some conserved quantity, therefore, that's associated with this symmetry? Note that this is, well, it would be, in principle, if this symmetry was a variational symmetry. But the problem in this case, and this is by no means unique, is that the heat equation does not have a Lagrangian formulation. It just doesn't have one. But we can do a trick. We can introduce an auxiliary scalar field, V, and introduce this Lagrangian density. We can apply Hamilton's principle by varying V, not U, not the temperature scalar, and out pops the Euler-Lagrange equation, which is exactly the heat equation. Now, the heat equation, I should have noted before, is clearly time reversal non-symmetric. This is exactly what you would expect for heat. And the transformation that we saw before, the scaling transformation, is a dynamical symmetry of this equation, but not a variational symmetry of this Lagrangian. So we don't expect, even though we have a Lagrangian formulation, a kind of a trick Lagrangian formulation, we don't expect to see an inertia charge, a conservation principle associated with this transformation. However, there are other cases, interesting cases. So let's consider, for time purposes, restrict ourselves to this case. Consider adding to the scalar field an arbitrary constant field, scalar field. That is, that variation is a quasi-symmetry, not a strict symmetry, a quasi-symmetry of this Lagrangian. And therefore, we can apply Noether's machinery. And what pops out of Noether's machinery in combination with Hamilton's principle is a continuity equation. And amusingly, the continuity equation is exactly the original heat equation. And you see this quite often in the case of applications of Noether's theorem to equations of motion that themselves take the form of a continuity equation. Now, if we integrate, this is something that you don't, this little step is not something you find in Noether's paper, but it's standard throughout the literature. If you integrate this continuity equation over space, then what we have here is the integration of the divergence of a gradient of u. And by Gauss's theorem, that's going to be a surface integral. And if the gradient of u falls off sufficiently fast with distance, that term will vanish. And we're left with the statement that the integral of u over space is a constant of the motion. In other words, the integral of u over space is the Noether charge. Now, this conservation principle associated with the heat equation has been known for a very long time. But as far as I know, the first analysis using Noether's theorem took place in 2004. This in a way is not altogether surprising because Noether's theorem is widely cited in physics. It's one of the most important theorems in theoretical physics, but it was barely used, hardly referred to until well after 1950. So Noether's original paper was 1918. Very little was used, very little evidence of the theorem appeared in the physics literature before about 1960. Well, there was a famous paper by Hill in the Reviews of Modern Physics in the early 50s, and that kicked off a lot of interest, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon literature.
10 minutes plus questions, Harvey.
Okay, thank you. Well, the quantum analog is that you take almost exactly the same Lagrangian, in this case for the Schrodinger equation and its complex conjugate. You vary, using Hamilton's principle, you vary the complex conjugate. You end up with the Schrodinger equation for the free particle. Now, of course, the miracle is that it's time reversal invariant. And that's because this extra variable here, the wave function, the complex conjugate of the wave function, is no longer just an auxiliary non-physical variable. It is the wave function that you, looking backwards in time. So it has a physical significance, and that's what makes the Schrodinger equation time-reversal, complex Schrodinger equation, time-reversal invariant. And now, if we rescale the wave function, it's, again, a dynamical, but it's not a variational symmetry, except when the modulus of this complex number, this complex field here, is equal to one. And that's highly non-trivial, because that corresponds to a global gauge transformation of the wave function. And of course, Noether's theorem applied in that case leads to an important result. I won't go through it here, it's very well known. But we can act, again, we can take an analogy with the heat equation, we can add an arbitrary complex number field to the wave function. We use the Noether machinery, we get back as a continuity equation, the original Schrodinger equation for the free particle. And then it turns out that, again, if the gradient of the wave function decreases fast enough in space, we end up with a Noether charge. This thing is conserved. In other words, the integral of the wave function over space is a conserved quantity. And this, again, is a use of the Noether theorem as applied to a quasi rather than a strict symmetry. Now, finally, we're going to get to temporal homogeneity in the last part of the talk. And here, I think these two quotes basically capture the standard approach in the literature. Here's Landau and Lifshitz. There are some quantities, like energy momentum, whose constancy is of profound significance, deriving from the fundamental homogeneity and isotropy of space and time. In a slightly more dramatic way, Z, in his book Fearful Symmetry, says the following: when I heard about Noether's insight, I was profoundly impressed. The revelation that these basic conservation laws follow from the assumption that physics is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, that's temporal homogeneity, here, there, and everywhere, that's spatial translation invariance, the homogeneity of space, east, west, north, and south, the spatial isotropy, was for me, as Einstein put it, essentially spiritual. So the idea, which is very, very common in the physics literature, is that the ultimate explanation of conservation principles, or at least these conservation principles, associated with the symmetry properties of space and time. Now, there are counterexamples. There's a beautiful one associated with the free Maxwell field, which I don't have time to go through now. Maybe I can come back to that in the discussion. But what I want to consider is the simplest possible case you can imagine of dynamics, which is just the free motion of a non-relativistic particle in one dimension. And here's the Lagrangian, single degree of freedom Q. And if we apply Hamilton's principle to this Lagrangian, of course, we end up with Q double dot is equal to zero, which is, we interpret as the acceleration is zero, so the body is moving inertially in conformity with Newton's first law of motion. And because we know that this Lagrangian has a gauge freedom, let's consider, for the sake of argument, introducing this gauge addition here, this total divergence. And you'll see in a moment why I've chosen this particular example, this particular gauge-related Lagrangian. So let's consider, as an example of Noether's theorem, the boost symmetry. So we're replacing Q by Q prime is equal to Q plus an infinitesimal parameter here that has the dimensions of velocity times T. This is the boost transformation. And it's widely known, understood, that the boost symmetry is a quasi-symmetry of the standard Lagrangian. It's not a strict symmetry. And for some time I was interested in which Lagrangian would this boost symmetry be a strict symmetry of, not a quasi-symmetry. And after returning to Noether's paper after something like 20 years, I discovered that she knew it. And here it is. This is the Lagrangian for which the boost transformation is a strict symmetry. Now, in Noether's original paper, none of this has any physical interpretation. These are just mathematical results. But at any rate, applying Noether's machinery, the boost symmetry is famously associated with the conservation of center of mass motion. This is the version in the case of a single particle in one dimension. But now the question arises, is there a strict symmetry of this Lagrangian that gives rise to the center of mass motion? And the answer is yes, and here it is. And again, this is found in Noether's paper. So this is a transformation that depends on derivatives of the dependent variable. I could say more about that later, but this is a strict symmetry of, this is a strict symmetry of this Lagrangian, I misstated that before, and a quasi-symmetry of this Lagrangian. And both of them give rise, through Noether's theorem, to the conservation of center of mass motion. Which symmetry is responsible for the conservation law? Finally, and I'm grateful for your patience, finally we get on to temporal homogeneity. So we have again the same system with these two gauge-related Lagrangians, and here is the transformation that refers, that corresponds to temporal homogeneity. It's just adding a constant infinitesimal parameter to the time variable. This is a symmetry of L, it's a quasi-symmetry of L prime. And of course, it leads to the conservation of energy. But there, the story continues. Here is a quasi-symmetry of L, a quasi-symmetry of L prime, that leads again to the conservation of energy. Here's a quasi-symmetry of L and a quasi-symmetry of L prime, a distinct one, that leads to the conservation of energy. And finally, this is a quasi-symmetry of L and a symmetry of this, a strict symmetry of this Lagrangian. All of these transformations are associated by Noether's first theorem with the conservation of energy. Which symmetry is responsible for the conservation law? Well, there's a fairly straightforward way of introducing an equivalence class of symmetries in which all of these belong to the same symmetry class. And a similar thing can happen in relation to conservation principles. And that leads me to a theorem which I think really is the modern correct version of Noether's first theorem, due to Martinez Alonso in 1979 and independently Peter Olver in 1986 and 1993. And it goes something like this. If the Lagrangian is a non-degenerate variational problem, which means essentially that the dynamics is neither under or over determined, there is a one-to-one correspondence between suitably defined equivalence classes of non-trivial conservation laws of the Euler-Lagrange equations and suitably defined equivalence classes of variational symmetries of the action. So in other words, one is establishing not a one-to-one correspondence between symmetries and conservation principles, but between classes, equivalence classes of symmetries and equivalence classes of conservation principles. And it's important to note that this theorem and its converse, that's to say the fact that it's a one-to-one correspondence, is not found in Noether's original work. Noether has a converse to her theorem, but that theorem, looking at it strictly, Noether's first theorem has nothing to do with conservation principles. So this is the first time that a one-to-one correspondence, in other words, going from symmetries to conservation principles, one can go back from conservation principles to symmetries. This is the first such theorem in the literature. Good. Well, just finishing, why the widespread explanatory priority of symmetries? Maida, how much time do I have left?
About 9 minutes.
Including the discussion?
No, this is just question time.
So I have 9 minutes of question time left?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I'm going to skip this. I mean, one could ask oneself why it is that in physics, despite the MAO theorem, symmetry seemed to be given priority in terms of explanatory power. But I'm going to skip over that for the moment and end up with a conclusion. The widespread notion that symmetries explain conservation laws is probably due to some pragmatic considerations, which I would have mentioned in the last slide. Certainly not to the modern Noetherian logic, which is the MAO, Martinez-Alonso, Oliver theorem. And in particular, doubts arise regarding the role of the homogeneity of time as the source of energy conservation in physics. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Henri, for a great talk. So I can see already three questions. We can start by Lee.
Thank you very, very much. That was a beautiful talk, Harv.
Thank you.
My question is about the possibility of a different kind of definition of a reverse or an inverse Noether's theorem, which we have been trying to state. And roughly speaking, it says if you have a causal set and you have energy and momentum on the edge, on the causal relations and on the events, and energy and momentum are conserved at the events, then there exists an embedding of the causal graph in a space-time with symmetry.
Well, are you asking what kind of connection this may have with Noether's theorem?
Yes, and with all the different versions you talked about.
Yes, well, of course, Noether's theorem, strictly speaking, applies to variational problems.
Yes, no, I'm in that class of problems.
Right, okay. I think I would have to see the details, Lee, to see how this connects with the original theorem in that case.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now Marius, you want to ask your question?
Thank you. Thank you very much for the nice talk. My question is basically, how do you think about taking into account general relativity? Because once we do put the metric as a variable that we can vary over, none of this applies basically. There's no conservation laws of this kind. There are for specific space times, but then we're not varying the metric. We're choosing a background again. So for a theory like general relativity that's background dependent and you have the metric, the space of solutions generically will not have killing fields and the rest to define energy and so on. How you had some slide where it was saying that physics are in this conservation laws. How are we going to take this? There's no physics in relativity or to adapt it somehow.
Yeah.
How do you think
about that? Well, thank you very much for the question. One of the things that I failed to mention in the course of this talk is that the symmetries involved in Noether's first theorem, with the theorem that I'm talking about in this talk, these involve the symmetry groups whose the infinitesimal parameters in the symmetry groups are constant in the sense they're not functions of space and time. In other words, such symmetries, sometimes called global symmetries, are not like the diffeomorphism freedom in general relativity. So Noether's first theorem doesn't apply to the diffeomorphism freedom, diffeomorphism invariance of Einstein's field equations. However, just let me make an historical point. Why did Noether do this work? She was called to Göttingen by David Hilbert because Hilbert was working on the Einstein's general relativity program and was having a very hard time understanding what the conservation principles mean. He and Klein were very confused about conservation principles in general relativity or the lack thereof. So Noether was called to Göttingen to essentially develop her second theorem, which are the consequences of a variational principle involving not global symmetries, but so-called local symmetries involving, you know, parameters that depend on space and time, such as in diffeomorphism transformations. And there, you do not get straightforwardly conservation principles. And she showed how this works in great detail.
Thank you. Maybe we could see this in the discussion, but I wasn't talking about diffeomorphism. But I was talking about global symmetries. Essentially, that would mean having killing fields.
Okay.
And generic solutions do not have these symmetries.
That's true. But on the other hand, there's the Einstein equivalence principle that tells us that locally in general relativity, the fundamental equations of special relativity hold, which is to say, the equations governing the non-gravitational interactions with respect to these very special local inertial frames take our Lorentz covariant and take their standard form. I mean, this has to do with the minimal coupling between the metric and the degrees of freedom associated with the non-gravitational interactions, so the matter fields. And there, insofar as one can ignore locally curvature effects, and we do this kind of thing all the time in general relativity, all of these considerations related to Noether's first theorem still apply. Of course, the conservation principles are not exact because we're overlooking the effects of curvature. But for example, if the effects of curvature can be regarded as very, very small with respect to, in other words, the inhomogeneities of the gravitational field are very, very small with respect to the effects that we're interested in, then all of Noether's first, all the machinery of Noether's first theorem can be applied.
Right, but then there's no gravity. That's, anyway, thank you very much for the.
Thank you.
I don't want to take up the time.
Okay, we've got 2 minutes left, two questions. Maybe we can do 1 minute question per person. Eric, you're next.
Thank you. So, Harvey, by happenstance, Carlo and I about a month ago had a disagreement about a claim, about the exact claim you made about the difference between thermometers and clocks. So I defended your position that there's this difference between thermometers as measuring devices and clocks as measuring devices. Carlo disagreed with me. And I think that we actually, and Carlo, please step in and correct me if I'm misrepresenting you. But I think that we managed to end up in agreement by disambiguating the claims we were making. And I think our agreement was that if you're talking about proper time in GR, then there is this kind of real interaction between the system and the metric, just like thermometer and, you know, liquid you stick it into. But if you're talking about coordinate time, then there's not. Would you agree with that? And when you talk about clocks and they're being weak measuring devices, are you talking about coordinate time and not proper time?
That's a very good point. And let's go back to Newton. Newton was interested in the first law of motion. You can take one particle in the universe. If it's sufficiently isolated from the rest, it'll move in a straight line at a uniform speed. So you could say that it's acting like a clock. It moves equal distances and equal times. This is something that you have to just posit in Newtonian physics. But as you know very well, Eric, in general relativity, there's a geodesic theorem. And the geodesic theorem has something to do with Einstein's field equations. And so Anderson, at one stage in his wonderful textbook on general relativity, made the very perceptive remark that there are no free particles in general relativity. Because a free body in general relativity is constrained to move along the geodesics of the metric by way of the Einstein's field equations. That's sort of a dynamical effect. And there are theorems to this, as you know, theorems to this effect. So insofar as the free body is a clock moving equal distances and equal times, it is being affected by the metric. I agree with that. But I think otherwise for things like wristwatches and atomic clocks, I think I'd stick by my slogan here.
I think Carlo has something to say.
Yeah, thank you.
Carlo, please.
I think what Eric said is it's very good, and I'm not sure how that you've responded. Namely, of course, we can take approximations and neglect something, but you said at some point that a clock measures time and not vice versa. Time acts on a clock, but the clock does not act on time. In general relativity, the ideal clock is just measuring the integral of g mu nu along a geodetic, the proper time, but that's there's no ideal clock. Any real clock has a energy which is affecting back the same G mu nu, which is measuring. So it's exactly the action and reaction that Einstein is telling. So what you said, of course, is completely correct. It's true, because you were not talking about general relativity. You were talking about special relativity. But once you step in general relativity, clocks are things that measure a thing, which is the time defined by the metric field and affect the metric field. And in fact, the interaction term in the Hamiltonian is a function of both and each act on the other one. So it's a beautiful restoration of the action and reaction in some very wild sense that Einstein was referring to.
Sorry for interrupting.
We are out of time, and if you don't mind, we can move the discussion to the discussion session. Thank you again, Harvey, for your great talk.